KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. And what a week it was. A story at the top of our program that's been years in the making. New Mexico's legislature has approved the legalization of recreational marijuana for adults 21 and older in a bill the governor plans to sign, extending the legal cannabis market in the American Southwest by April of next year. That's when New Mexico is expected to begin issuing licenses. The State House concurred with Senate amendments on Wednesday to provide the legislature's final approval. A companion bill would automatically erase some past marijuana convictions and reconsider criminal sentences for about 100 prisoners. Well, this week's vote to legalize adult-use marijuana in New Mexico comes, as we said, after years of failures. In the past, the math just wasn't there. With some Democrats joining Republicans in opposing the legalization, New Mexico watched while neighboring state Colorado raked in more than $1 billion in revenue, and even heavily Republican states like Arizona approved legalization efforts too. So you might call it fitting that State Senator Katie Duhigg spoke before the vote. The Democrat was elected last year, defeating Republican incumbent Candace Gould.
And I want to thank all the members of this body who have, you know, vigorously debated this issue, really been incredibly thoughtful about it. And I think that the bill that we have before us now is better because of that attention and that input from the members of this body.
While Republicans voted against the legislation, one Republican, Senator Cliff Pirtle, introduced a marijuana legalization bill of his own. He said it didn't get adequate consideration and admitted he was most concerned about the process.
And, you know, my biggest fear isn't that we're passing a horrible piece of legislation. I think what's most disappointing to me is the destruction of the legislature that we've witnessed here.
And expect a lot more heated words in the year ahead. New Mexico is not expected to begin issuing adult-use marijuana licenses, as we said, until April of next year. Well, New Mexico will be the 17th state to legalize adult-use marijuana, but most states did this through ballot measures, not legislation. Megan Kamrick of the New Mexico PBS podcast Growing Forward talked with Natalie Fertig of Politico, who covers legalization efforts nationwide.
And so legislatures have been going back in after regulations were passed and either trying to change things from the ballot measures that maybe didn't work. Colorado, for example, famously allowed medical patients to grow 100 plants at home for the first couple of years, that the legislature then had to go in and drastically reduce that home grow limit, which was essentially a small farm. I think the closest to New Mexico would be either Virginia's legislation or Illinois' legislation, which both regulated cannabis and also addressed social equity, creating social equity funds and doing expungements.
What are the trends you're seeing across the country in terms of production control?
I mean, honestly, New Mexico, you guys are so interesting and an outlier in this whole thing nationally, because it's not something I've actually ever heard before, putting a cap on the number of plants that can be grown. Usually states discuss caps on licenses. So the cap on plants, that's a New Mexico only thing. And as someone who covers a lot of these states, I'm very excited to see how this plays out.
In Colorado, initially, you could grow up to 100 plants as a medical patient. Why did they come back and decide they had to fix that?
I should specify that that is for home cultivation rather than people doing that for sales. Washington State actually did the absolute opposite, where they did not even allow recreational or adult use consumers to home grow at all. Colorado kind of met them in the middle on recreational home grow, but home grow has been this kind of weird existential issue on the periphery of marijuana legislation for the entire history of adult use cannabis in the United States. It's seen as an equity issue. Communities of color do not have as much access to medical marijuana or recreational marijuana in those states where it's really expensive. It also, I should add, gives police one more reason to maybe go into someone's home.
How did other states that have legalized try to address some of the social justice and equity issues that the New Mexico legislation had?
Well, it's been a bumpy ride. California was one of the first states, along with Massachusetts and Illinois, to create social equity programs. But even some of these programs that were early, Massachusetts program, for example, has hit a lot of hurdles. Because one of the things that a lot of lawmakers did not recognize was that you can give equity applicants a head start, but you also need to give equity applicants the means to then succeed. I've seen in reporting on California, a lot of the people getting licenses are people coming from the real estate industry, and they have deep pockets and they have deep pocketed friends. And then you see someone coming from one of the communities that have been most impacted by the war on drugs, and they don't have deep pocketed friends. They don't have deep pockets themselves. They don't know how to talk to city council people. They don't know how to file all the complicated paperwork. And so even though they have priority status in the system, their doors aren't getting open. And a lot of the people with the power, a lot of the white men who, you know, have the institutional knowledge, which, not placing blame or anything, but that's the system and that's the reality, are progressing further than the equity applicants. It's a very, very complicated problem to solve. It's not just about solving cannabis criminalization. It's about changing an entire system of racism and economic racism in the United States. And you can't just fix one part of that and expect the whole system to work differently from all the other systems. Also, federal illegality continues to impact those systems as well. I talked to Kat Packer, who's in charge of Los Angeles's cannabis industry, and she told me that the money that they receive from the federal government to help lower income communities start small businesses is not accessible to the cannabis industry because that's federal funding. And then they were scrambling to try to find the funds to then help these people in an industry where starting a cannabis dispensary can be $1 million or more.
And that was Natalie Fertig of Politico talking with Megan Kamrick. There's much more on this story online at the region's homepage, krwg.org. Look for the New Mexico Legislature section under the News tab. In other news this week, the Department of the Interior is re-examining federal programs that authorize oil and gas leasing on public lands. The stakes, of course, are high for New Mexico, which gets a large portion of its revenue from the leases. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Interior Secretary Deb Haaland says the Biden administration is considering ideas from political leaders on both sides of the aisle in order to rethink the management of energy and minerals on public lands.
There is no doubt that oil, gas, and coal energy from our public lands and ocean has helped build our economy and power our nation. Fossil fuels will continue to play a major role in America for years to come. But too often, the extraction of resources has been rushed to meet the false urgency of political timetables, rather than with careful consideration for the impacts of current or future generations.
Haaland noted the increase in leasing permits given out under the Trump administration, an action she says did not benefit the American people.
The potential impacts to people, water, wildlife, and climate were deliberately ignored, something the courts continue to address. While some corporations profited, taxpayers were shortchanged, and some Americans' voices were not heard.
While the minimum starting bid to lease an acre of public land is currently set at $2, the price has historically been driven up by competing companies. Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship President David Jenkins says the increase in leases has led to a lack of competition for land.
They were just making so much acreage available so fast that you didn't have that demand, and you didn't have people like driving up those prices by bidding against each other in a lot of cases.
President Biden put a temporary pause on authorizing new oil and gas leases on public lands and offshore waters in January in order to conduct a comprehensive review of the program. It's an action the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association has called into question, writing in a press release that oil and gas leases are essential to the health and stability of communities in New Mexico. Aztec Well Family Services Executive Vice President Jason Sandell highlighted how his New Mexico business has been impacted by the executive order.
We felt the impacts immediately. One of our drilling rigs had been called into action just about the time of the swearing in of President Biden. And almost immediately, we had to lay that rig down. We had called employees in, 25 people, to go out and staff this rig. And there were 100 more associated jobs, all called into action and then laid down.
While Sandell does not agree with Biden's executive order, he says he does appreciate the administration's commitment to fighting climate change. He stressed that mission does not have to mean the demise of the oil and gas industry.
It's a matter of embracing the all of the above approach, as has been communicated by our governor and others, rather than attempting to, as I said, put the death nail into oil and gas while renewables continue to grow. And then working together in that collaborative fashion to ensure that we've got stronger environmental protections that provide assurances that our development of natural resources is being done in the right and fair way.
Critics say selling new leases is only one issue that must be addressed. Royalty rates on public lands have been set at 12.5% for almost a century, an extremely low rate. The Center for Western Priorities says it's time for an update. In a statement on its website, the center says oil and gas companies stockpile leases, but fail to produce on many of them. The center notes the cost to leave lands idle is only $1.50 per acre annually, incentivizing speculation on public lands. And they say when companies hit hard times, they can abandon oil and gas wells, leaving taxpayers with the environmental risks and bills to clean up the mess. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
And Madison will be back later in the program to look at sustainability efforts in the state, including a lot more renewable energy in Las Cruces. To immigration now, and on his first day in office, President Joe Biden ordered a pause on border wall construction and a 60-day review of construction projects and contracts left by the Trump administration. The administration has yet to announce more plans for border wall construction. And now border residents and leaders like former El Paso Congressman Beto O'Rourke are renewing their calls for all wall projects to be officially canceled.
So on behalf of the people of El Paso, I implore the Biden administration to make the temporary pause on construction permanent and to seek to repair the damage done to so many of these border communities. And when making policy that will impact the border, listen to the people of the border first.
Even though construction appears to remain on hold for now, activists say lawsuits against border landowners have not yet been dismissed in South Texas courts. A large number of migrant children and teenagers have crossed into Texas, many of them without their parents. The League of United Latin American Citizens, known as LULAC, wants the Texas Rangers to play a role in helping these minors. KERA's Stella Chavez reports.
Governor Greg Abbott has claimed that some of the migrant children coming to Texas have been brought in by child sex traffickers or have been used to transport drugs. Dallas immigration attorney Fernando de Bove says he wants these kids, who are mainly teenage boys, to be granted an S visa. That's for undocumented immigrants who help law enforcement in a criminal investigation.
Once you have that application filed and then you get a hearing date with an immigration judge, the fact that you have that application filed usually lets the immigration judge basically stay the case or leave it pending or continue the case until that visa is adjudicated. So just filing the application helps the kids down the road when they go before an immigration judge.
LULAC also wants state and federal officials to work together to place the teens in foster homes while they wait for their next steps. I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
Well, the push is on to improve conditions for migrants at U.S. facilities. El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar says conditions for detained migrants have improved since President Joe Biden took office, but she still describes some facilities holding children as heartbreaking and unacceptable.
We are at least now providing clothing and shoes toothbrushes, showers, clean clothes, two hot meals a day.
Escobar spoke to MSNBC. She and other U.S. representatives toured a migrant processing center in El Paso last weekend. To business news now, and New Mexico State University is launching a new center to foster economic development on the border. KRWG intern Sarah Rodriguez reports.
New Mexico State University is launching the Center for Border Economic Development, also known as CBED. The project is led by longtime NMSU professor and economics department head, Dr. Chris Erickson. Erickson describes the center's focus.
Institution within NMSU is being set up to help with economic development on the border. And what we're doing is we are seeking to identify problems that are impeding economic development, and then we're attempting to identify resources that can be brought to bear on those issues.
Erickson says that the goal of the CBED is to bring economic efficiency and prosperity to southern New Mexico's border region.
We're looking at this issue about transportation. We're looking at the issues of COVID. We're looking at other issues along those lines. Kind of the point is to identify what's needed and get it there.
Erickson says that the CBED will include an online database for a wide variety of subjects and resources relating to border economic development.
We plan on also developing a data webpage that people can access and find data about the border easily. And these are not just things like a number of workers or something like that, but also, for example, air pollution levels. We're also thinking about including things like incidence of COVID in the different municipios and counties along the border. And these are information that people can have, and we plan on and hope to have this updated on a very regular basis going forward. And that's the kind of resource that's going to be made available.
Lucinda Vargas, a postdoctoral fellow working with Erickson on the CBED, discusses the goal of collecting research on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border.
When we talk about the border, we may lose sight that we're talking about two countries. Yes, Las Cruces, Doña Ana, NMSU, we're situated on the border, but that implies two sides of it, right? The U.S. side and the Mexican side. So our whole sort of mandate will be to keep databases on both sides of what's happening on both sides of the border.
Vargas says that the CBED will also focus on comparing southern New Mexico's border with other borders in the United States in terms of economic opportunities.
As we sort of celebrate, that's a word that just came to mind, our border geographic location, and I say celebrate because we need to think of it strategically. It's a strategic location. Well, how do we compare to other borders? What does New Mexico have that maybe other border city pairs don't have that we can exploit to our benefit? But vice versa, what are other border city pairs doing that we have yet to do that could work for our benefit?
Vargas says that the CBED will also help foster a more competitive border for New Mexico.
We talk about a competitive border, more business opportunities, business expansions, recognizing that maybe the international dimension of things is not being recognized by some businesses because it's not been highlighted. So if we highlight it by offering data and resources and possibility of how we can make that work for businesses, I think it's very promising.
The CBED project has required hard work and determination, as Erickson and Vargas strive to make a difference in southern New Mexico's border economy.
This is an entrepreneurial type of project. We are out actively seeking to find where we can make a difference. It's not one of these things where you just sit back and wait for someone to call you. And so we're out in the communities, we're talking to people. We've met with politicians, officials, we've met with many people in the public, of course. Economic development, it involves the hard work of developing resources that attract the businesses who come and open up. And so that means infrastructure. That means education.
It takes, you know, vision, because these are not projects that are packaged very easily. You know, you're talking about, you know, really being creative on how we can come up with a solution, but we think we need to be addressed.
The Center for Border Economic Development will continue to be developed through NMSU. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Sarah Rodriguez.
KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. A new study says sexual assault and harassment in the U.S. military is causing troops to leave prematurely, hurting readiness. The authors hope it will help military leaders understand the costs of sex crimes extend beyond the victims affected. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
When Amber Davila joined the Army in 2011, she planned to stay in for the full 20, or until retirement. She took pride in her communication security job. It made her feel like part of a team and a greater good.
I used to joke that I was going to eventually become the first female command sergeant major of the Army.
That all changed when Davila was sexually assaulted by a fellow soldier in Korea. Even though she was terrified of being ostracized, she eventually reported her attacker, and he was discharged after a lengthy investigation. But for Davila, the ordeal wasn't over.
You think you're okay, and then, you know, the commander says, horseshoe on me, so everybody kind of moves in. And then suddenly someone's brushing against me and I'm right back in that formation in Korea where this man is torturing me. And it just became overwhelming.
She spiraled into anxiety and destructive behavior and spent more and more energy trying to appear fine. When it came time to re-enlist, she had a panic attack.
And that's when I decided I couldn't do it anymore and that I needed to get out.
Davila isn't alone in that decision. According to a new study by the RAND Corporation, sexual assault doubled the odds that a service member would leave the military within 28 months. And about a quarter of troops who were sexually harassed didn't re-up. Andrew Morrell is a senior behavioral scientist at RAND and the study's lead author.
We all know, I think, that sexual assault and sexual harassment has tremendous costs to the individuals involved in it. But I think less attention has been paid to what the institutional costs are.
Using Defense Department data, he tracked the careers of a group of service members who reported sexual assault or harassment. Then he used statistical analysis to figure out how their experiences translated to the entire force. Assaults were associated with about 2,000 more people leaving the military than would normally be expected. Sexual harassment contributed to the departure of an additional 8,000 service members. Most who left did so by choice, often sacrificing retirement and other benefits.
They may not have felt like they had much choice if it was a very toxic work environment, but they weren't kicked out.
After the killing of Specialist Vanessa Guillen at Fort Hood in Central Texas, an independent review found that commanders weren't paying enough attention to sexual assault and harassment. In some cases, non-commissioned officers didn't encourage reporting and shamed victims. Morrell says that's been a problem across the military, but he hopes framing sexual assault and harassment as a retention problem will get their attention.
Well, I hope that they use it to emphasize the importance of leadership promoting a command climate that is not permissive with respect to sexual assault and sexual harassment kinds of behaviors. You know, I think it's been hard to get those messages all the way down into the junior enlisted ranks.
President Biden recently ordered a 90-day commission to pursue solutions to sexual assault in the military. One of its goals is to figure out how to reorient the culture against sex crimes. Lynn Rosenthal, a longtime advocate for survivors of gender violence, heads the commission. She told reporters in February that she'll organize listening sessions with service members, especially survivors.
This commission says to that service member, you do belong in this military. You belong. And it's our job to make this climate safe for you to be here.
The commission is slated to give recommendations to the president this summer. That's too late for former service members like Amber Davila. Since leaving the military in 2015, she started work for the Pink Berets, a women veterans organization in San Antonio. It supports survivors of military sexual trauma and advocates for policy change. But she says she feels a lingering grief about her service, especially when talking with friends whose Army careers have taken off. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
And that story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration reporting on American military life and veterans. funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Carson Frame will be back later in the program with part two of her look at sexual assault in the military and what's being done about it. A sweeping Republican voting bill is making its way through the GOP-controlled Texas legislature. The bill is advancing after hours of testimony, mostly opposing the legislation. Among those criticizing the measure is someone we heard from earlier, former El Paso Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke.
This bill makes voting harder. It is unjust. It is undemocratic with a small d, and I hope that you will oppose it.
The legislation would limit early voting hours, prevent local election officials from encouraging people to fill out mail-in voting applications, and it would outright ban drive-through voting. To environmental news now, and jaguars once roamed much of the Southwest. Now, conservationists are pushing for an expanded habitat for the animals. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports.
Ryan Bird with Defenders of Wildlife says independent research found 20 million acres of suitable habitat in the central mountains of Arizona and New Mexico that would support the big cats.
Some of us believe that because jaguar are part of the native fauna of the United States, that we should be doing more to recover them here.
The federal recovery plan primarily recommends helping Mexico preserve its native jaguar population. Bird says the new area identified by the study for jaguar reintroduction is 27 times larger than the current designated habitat and could help bring the big cat back to the U.S. The multidisciplinary group of scientists compared 12 habitat models for jaguars in Arizona and New Mexico, not considered in the recovery plan prepared by the Wildlife Service. But Bird notes that the federal agency left open the possibility of revising boundaries if new information became available. He says jaguars once ranged from Louisiana to California in the southern U.S. and as far north as the Grand Canyon.
It's been so long since some of these more spectacular, charismatic animals have been permanent residents of the United States. We sort of lost that history.
Over the last two decades, a number of male jaguars have been photographed in the mountains south of I-10 in Arizona and New Mexico. At the same time, Bird acknowledges that jaguar restoration to the Southwest has been made more difficult by construction of the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Commentary now, and we have been dealing with pandemic restrictions for more than a year. Some are getting impatient. Thoughts on that now from commentator Peter Goodman.
It's spring, and we seem to be reopening. Unless some vaccine-resistant COVID-19 variant functions like the groundhog's shadow. It's like watching plants poke their heads out of the dirt with the shy determination of a kid attending a first dance. Just when we've planted our first tomatoes, vaccinated people are dining with friends indoors, baseball teams are opening the season with partially filled stands, March Madness is in full swing, the local bridge club is discussing when and how to reopen, and the Black Box Theater will soon have small but live audiences, outdoors, in the garden. It wants to feel good. But people are still dying. The virus is still morphing. Doña Ana County is yellow, not green, in New Mexico's color-coded system. Vaccine resistors might help the virus plague us longer than necessary. Many workers are being exposed to possible infection at their jobs, and other countries, mostly poorer ones, haven't yet acquired enough vaccine. So people seem cautiously relieved, not joyful. I hadn't greatly feared getting infected, though I consistently wore a mask in public and was careful, delaying unnecessary ventures into stores. I've been playing pickleball outdoors with everyone masked. I go to court some, but I sure felt pleased and relieved after getting vaccinated. We have a lot of healing to do. Many are grieving. Some who are grieving feel anger toward Republicans for not repudiating a leader who let more people die than necessary. Many folks who did not believe in masks are angry at being forced to wear them. Some of the folks who gave us the January 6th attack on Congress are now shouting that vaccines could wipe out humanity. On all sides, our differing personal choices during the pandemic have widened and deepened a divide that was already rancorous. For some folks, the need to pull together, as in wartime, may have muted partisan sniping, but for most, it is otherwise. All over town, people sniped at each other over wearing or not wearing masks or what should be open or closed. Will that anger, even contempt, fade as quickly as our peach blossoms? So we need to heal from our great losses and suffering, and from the cabin fever or even mental illness many have experienced, from stalled educations, sports development and careers, and devastated businesses. And we need to stay sensible and focused on getting through this together. Infections rose last week in 32 states, not including New Mexico, and Brazil just set a new high for new infections in a day. So let's not drop the ball while celebrating.
We hear so many compliments on Peter's work. If you have one, or if you have a viewpoint of your own, email us. The address is feedback@nmsu.edu. Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. On the Health Watch this week, colon cancer. Studies in 2019 and last year found Hispanic adults more likely to be diagnosed in later stages than white adults. KERA's Sam Baker talked about this with Dr. Roberto Rodriguez, a colorectal surgery specialist in Dallas.
I think the number one contributing factor is they're ashamed of seeking advice for changing bowel habits or for any type of symptoms. And I think there's some degree of social stigma of being checked by a colorectal surgeon. And they just put up with symptoms until it gets to a point that is unbearable. And unfortunately, by then, it's too late. Number two, some limitation on resources. They may not have insurance or the resources to get a colonoscopy, see the doctor, and that may be another contributing factor.
The study itself suggested improving access to care among Latinos would be a major step in improving the situation.
I think access to care is readily available. It's just making sure that people are aware that they can get care. Again, we go back to social upbringing and cultural idiosyncrasies that may be contributing to that. And we just need to make them aware that care is available and access is readily available too.
So then tell me, I would imagine in terms of getting information then to Latinos, maybe interviews like this are a start. So later stages of colorectal cancer, is being diagnosed at that stage a death sign, or can you be treated and live on even at that stage?
Yes, a lot of advances have been made lately with chemotherapy agents. Nowadays, they're better tolerated. We see better responses to chemotherapy. Advances in surgical technology also allows them to have their care, their surgery, recover quicker. So it's not necessarily a death sentence immediately like it used to be years ago. I have patients with advanced stages that can live for many years, 5 years, even with those advanced stages. The one thing that you have to consider with advanced stages is also the biology of the tumor. There are some tumors that are more aggressive than others. And obviously, those that are more aggressive, then the life expectancy would be shorter. But in general, the most common colon cancers are sort of in the middle of the road, and survivals, even in advanced stages, can be for years with appropriate treatment.
What else do you suppose could improve screening rates for colon cancer?
Probably the number one is education. The patient's understanding that stool tests are relatively simple and colonoscopies are very safe. Also, the understanding that you can prevent cancer if you remove premalignant polyps. And colon cancer is potentially curable if you catch it on an early stage.
If education is important, though, just as you say, there's a stigma about undergoing colonoscopies. Would it help if Latinos who have undergone colonoscopies simply talked more to others about having gone through that process?
The best advocates of prevention are my own patients. It's not uncommon that young individuals that have colon cancer, they immediately start telling their friends and family, and it's not unusual for them to come and see me because a friend that I had taken care of in the past recommended that. So most definitely the best advocates would be colon cancer survivors.
Dr. Rodriguez, thank you for being with me.
Thank you so much.
And now part two of our special series on sexual assault in the military. The Army admitted in November its sexual assault and harassment prevention program is broken. Now, one elite Army Corps is taking matters into its own hands, asking soldiers and survivors for ideas to fix it. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
Staff Sergeant Shamika Dudley says she wants to show soldiers what it's like to walk in somebody else's boots.
That is the goal right there. Empathy, because that's an issue we have too. You know, if someone comes forward, male or female, and say like, hey, I feel like I've been sexually harassed, usually what happens is it's like, maybe you're taking it wrong.
Early in her Army career, Dudley, a linguist at Fort Bragg, helped support a friend who was assaulted. She says other soldiers were nearby and could have intervened to stop the crime. So in February, she pitched an idea to the 18th Airborne Corps: use virtual reality to get soldiers to be proactive.
If you were a bystander in this situation, you can be like, hey, what you're doing is wrong.
Dudley was one of seven finalists at the 18th Airborne Corps' Dragon's Lair event. It's normally a Shark Tank-style competition where the Army asks for tech proposals from rank-and-file soldiers. But this time, instead of focusing on tanks and computers, it asked for suggestions to improve its sexual harassment and assault response program, what the Army calls SHARP. Colonel Joe Bacchino was part of the team that put Dragon's Lair together. He's the innovation officer for the 18th Airborne Corps.
With the SHARP program, you have to have buy-in. You have to have trust at the lowest level. And if people don't have trust in the SHARP program, then you don't really have a SHARP program because people aren't really going to report.
Bacchino says there's been a lot of pressure to rebuild that trust since the death of Fort Hood, Texas specialist Vanessa Guillen last year. An independent review panel found Fort Hood's climate to be permissive of sexual assault and harassment. The 18th Airborne Corps isn't based at Fort Hood. It's headquartered at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. But Bacchino says the problem is Army-wide.
You know, Fort Hood is not some other planet. Fort Hood is a part of the United States Army. These problems are manifest on big Army installations. So there's public pressure, and there's congressional pressure, and there's soldier pressure, and there's soldiers on social media, and there's soldiers talking to their chain of command.
The suggestions were wide-ranging. One Dragon's Lair contestant recommended putting more women on the boards that decide whether assailants will get kicked out of the Army. She also wanted to see career incentives for soldiers who act like allies. Another pitched the idea of having volunteers watch for problems at the unit level. The 18th Airborne Corps could take some of those steps itself, but others, like changing how punishment is meted out or giving SHARP more manpower, are up to the Army. Still, Captain Megan Mejia, an Army lawyer, says she feels empowered to take action. She was one of the panelists who reviewed the presentations.
We can do more without having that systematic change, right? We can close the information gap with our leaders and junior enlisted. We can talk to them. We can provide more training. If everyone is buying in, then it's getting better automatically.
The 18th Airborne Corps has committed to implementing the concepts of all seven Dragon's Lair finalists. It's also sharing insights with Army leaders who are in the process of revamping SHARP. But the buck may not stop there. In late February, the Pentagon announced a civilian-led commission to address military sexual assault. Once formed, the commission will have 90 days to compile its recommendations and will report directly to President Biden. This is Carson Frame reporting.
Funding for that series provided in part by the Corporation for public broadcasting. Some say it's time for the NCAA to update its rules, including commentator Walt Rubel.
Rodeo may be the only college sport that isn't knee-deep in hypocrisy. That's because rodeo is not part of the NCAA and has never held romanticized notions about the purity of amateur athletics. And so, college athletes in rodeo compete for prize money. The ones who do the best earn the most. The NCAA recently reported that the 2018-2019 men's basketball season generated a total of $864.6 million in total net income. The 20 most profitable college football teams generated even more, bringing in a combined $925 million. College coaches have reaped the rewards that come with heading a multi-million dollar operation. Kentucky basketball coach John Calipari makes $8.158 million a year. Alabama football coach Nick Saban makes $9.3 million a year. And yet, in the make-believe world of the NCAA, the best players on the Kentucky basketball team and Alabama football team are worth no more than the best sprinter on the track team. A full scholarship is the most any of them are eligible for. Anytime a rule is that divorced from reality, it's destined to be broken often. Boosters with a deep affection for their alma mater and deeper pockets have found creative ways over the years to lure top athletes to their school with cars, gifts, and money handed out under the table. Now, state legislatures are stepping in to challenge the NCAA. Florida recently joined with California and Colorado in passing a law to allow college athletes to profit from their name, image, or likeness in violation of NCAA rules. A similar law was passed by the New Mexico legislature and is pending consideration by Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham. The NCAA is tweaking its rules while at the same time lobbying Congress to block the new state laws. But NCAA leaders can't have it both ways. They can't rake in millions of dollars, competing with professional sports leagues, movies, concerts, and other forms of entertainment, while still pretending that their primary function is the education of star athletes. The new state laws will only increase the divide between the haves and the have-nots. They'll ensure that more resources go to the money sports, and less to the other sports.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. Coming up tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock on KRWG-TV, I hope you'll join us for a special edition of Newsmakers. Here is a preview of what you'll see tomorrow morning at 11 from Madison Staton, who has a special report on sustainability efforts in Las Cruces and across the state.
New Mexico is one of the fastest warming states in the nation, with the number of days classified as dangerous due to heat expected to double by 2050. The city of Las Cruces is taking action, pledging a 19% decrease in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. I talked with both state and city representatives to learn more about what's being done locally.
Las Cruces experienced 5 weeks of extreme heat during the summer of 2020. Historic temperatures included 9 days over 105 degrees, something state climatologist David Dubois says is evidence of a larger trend.
The last 30 years, we've seen a climb in temperature. It's a small climb, but it's sort of, it's that continuous, every year we see a shift in warmer temperatures. You know, there are natural cycles that are going on, like El Niños and La Niñas, that we see up and down trends, but there's this long-term warming that's underlying all of that.
The rising temperature is just one reason Las Cruces has adopted a climate action plan with a goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions 19% by 2030.
Realize that together, commercial and residential buildings contribute about 40% of our carbon emissions for Las Cruces. And we want to reduce carbon emissions through energy efficiency and encouraging the use of clean energy through our utilities or other sources. And it's important for the city to have a strong energy efficiency codes and other regulations that lessen the burden for the low and moderate income communities, especially who are hardest hit.
The Rock also says transportation, the biggest polluter, will be a top priority.
Half of Las Cruces' carbon emissions come from the vehicles we use to drive around the city. And our system benefits those cars, and it benefits people who have cars and limits opportunities for those without them. Yet we all pay for road improvements and suffer from air pollution and the cleanup costs. And so to address this, we want to create mobile hubs where people have access to public transit, electric bikes, and walking trails. We want to develop compact communities that have all the services we need in walking distance. And for those that need cars, we want to encourage the use of electric vehicles.
Las Cruces City Councilor Gil Sorg, who strongly supports the city's transition to clean energy, recently spoke to KRWG about efforts to replace city-owned gasoline vehicles with electric ones.
We have 5 buses on order now. My goal here is when we need to replace a vehicle and there's an available on the market at a price that is within reason of a gasoline-powered vehicle, we convert to electric vehicles then.
State climatologist David Dubois says the goals outlined by the city are attainable, but he says residents without access to a cool location in the summer must get help.
There's quite a few people who have problems with extreme heat, and it seems like there's a growing number of people who it actually affects their life. And so I think that is one thing that we need to follow up on, and I think right away.
One way La Rock is hoping to combat extreme heat is by addressing the amount of asphalt and lack of trees. This can cause so-called heat islands, parts of the city that can get up to 15 degrees hotter than other areas.
Those surfaces absorb the heat and radiate it out. And this heat continues to radiate out throughout the day and even in the evening. We need to be more deliberate about adding cool surfaces like lighter pavement or porous surfaces where water can soak through, and an increased number of trees. This can make living conditions much more comfortable.
Above all, La Rock emphasized the importance of adapting in a changing climate, underscoring her excitement for continued city efforts.
This is really an exciting time to look and imagine what we can do without being wasteful, without being so polluting, and with being more harmonious in our planet.
To talk more about how renewable energy is being used in New Mexico, we're joined by the Sierra Club's Camilla Feibelman. Camilla, how common is it for local municipalities to have their own sustainability goals in New Mexico?
Well, actually, Albuquerque, where I live, is a really good example of a city that is taking action to build sustainability into the city's day-to-day work and goals. When Mayor Keller first came on, he set goals for the city's energy use itself, the municipality itself, and are looking at how to go beyond to make those energy, clean energy goals be applicable to everybody in the city, not just municipal operations. And the city now is going through a really well thought out collaborative process to make a city sustainability plan. But, you know, these plans are really only as good as the participation and the real communication and dedication from citizens to say, we want our city to be as sustainable as possible. So for example, Las Cruces itself has set really strong, especially climate goals. Santa Fe has done the same. And in each case, that drives the city's main utility to provide the city with even more renewable energy and use those goals as a touch point.
Wow. And what can you tell us about the impact climate change has already had on the state of New Mexico?
Yeah, that's the hard part. I think people sort of want climate change to be something that's off in the future and the impacts to be something we're still waiting to see. But unfortunately, we're seeing those impacts every day in New Mexico, whether that's sustained and long-term drought, whether that's the impact on species like the silvery minnow even, whether those are forest fires that burn faster and more furiously. And then around the country, whether that's worsened or stronger hurricanes, whether those are forest fires that take lives and have huge statewide impacts in places like California. Unfortunately, climate change is upon us, and we have to act as fast as we can, not only to save lives, not only to protect what makes a place like New Mexico so special to us, but also because it creates economic opportunities for us to innovate, for us to lead, to create local opportunities at home to transition.
Well, one way the state has worked to address climate concerns is through the Energy Transition Act, which was established in New Mexico back in 2019. Can you tell me how this act has worked to shape the state?
Yeah, for sure. So the Energy Transition Act deals with one aspect of the ways in which New Mexico contributes to global climate change, and that's through our electric sector. So we all are able to, thankfully, turn on the lights and keep our food cold and, you know, run a dishwasher. And for most people, that comes from electric generation. So in New Mexico, we have three big utilities around the state and then a series of other co-ops and municipal utilities that provide that electricity for all of us. And so over the years, what we have seen is that the coal industry is really going away, not just here in New Mexico, not just in the country, but around the world. We're seeing that there's a real falling out of the economics behind coal. And that's because for so long, you know, the coal industry got to dig it up and burn it and not pay for any of the costs, whether the environmental costs locally or the regional impacts of spewing pollution into the region, or nationally and globally around climate change. So finally, coal is starting to reflect the real cost to our society, and that means that it's expensive. So here in New Mexico, our coal-fired generation is starting to go away. Utilities are realizing it's just too expensive. But we wanted to make sure that when the big coal-fired power plants in the northwest of the state shut down, that people weren't left on their heels. I was born and raised in Albuquerque. My mother gave birth to me at Presbyterian Hospital. I went to Albuquerque High School. All that energy was supplied to our state by people, communities, and fossil resources in the northwest. And so I strongly feel as a New Mexican and also as the director of our Rio Grande chapter of the Sierra Club that we need to ensure that communities are thought about as we transition. So what the Energy Transition Act does is first it says utilities have to provide us with electricity that is increasingly generated with higher percentages of renewable energy.
Camilla Feibelman of the Sierra Club talking with Madison Staten. You can watch the full report, a special edition of Newsmakers, tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV, or right now in the local TV section at krwg.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Enjoy the rest of your weekends.